Welcome to Popcorn Talk, featuring movie discussions, news, and interviews, presenting the film scene with Ileana Douglas. Ileana is an actress, writer, author, and film historian with a need to discuss movies that borders on obsession. You'll learn the history of movies one great story at a time. The film scene is the deep cuts of movie podcasts, featuring movies we love by the people who made them. And now, Ileana Douglas.
Hello. Hi, everyone. It's Ileana Douglas, and you're listening to The Film Scene. I'm here with Jeff Graham.
Very excited. It's funny. It's only been 2 weeks, but so great to have the show back up.
Thank you. I know I missed everybody. I was in Tucson, Arizona at the Loft Cinema getting a lofty Lifetime Achievement Award.
Thank you.
It was very heavy. I had to carry it back on the plane.
Oh, yeah.
With the wonderful Allison Anders, we showed Grace of My Heart. Exciting news. Universal made a DCP of our, because the movie came out in 1997. So we made a DCP of it. And now other film festivals, if you're out there and you'd like to screen Grace of My Heart, we had a great sold out screening. We did a book signing afterwards. We actually ran out of books.
It keeps happening, Ileana. It's
I
good.
I know. So it's really nice, and the movie really holds up. And again, Allison and I keep pushing to get a re-release of the film and go into Universal, get some of the archives, put some of the scenes that we, you know, really feel we're missing.
Mm.
It's interesting with a movie like The Irishman out. How long is it? 6.5 hours?
I've heard 8 hours.
I'm seeing it this Sunday. So I'm going to take a nap before I see it. But
Make
anyway,
some coffee, caffeine.
Grace of My Heart is a movie that there were a couple scenes that were really in contention. Our executive producer, Martin Scorsese, Marty, wanted us to cut, and we really, really kind of disagreed about that. Mm. But we don't have the luxury. We didn't have the luxury of Final Cut. And all these years later, Allison Anders and I, every time we see the film, every few years, we look at each other and we say, yeah, I still miss those scenes.
Wow.
And so, as so many directors have, you know, they want to do their director's cut and put the scenes in. And this is my philosophy of a director's cut is, again, where you should have the license to put in everything that you feel was missing, maybe for the release. But anyway, we're hoping to do that. We're still praying that Universal has all of the elements that we can restore the film.
How do you feel watching yourself back? I know there are some actors who are like, I will never watch anything I'm in. I guess if you're happy with the project, you probably like watching it back.
It's a movie that is so personal to me that it's difficult to watch because, again, it's this collaboration with Allison Anders, a filmmaker that I really, really admired. Mm-hmm. And each time when we see it, I don't think I'm going to get emotionally carried away, but Allison halfway through the screening reached out and, you know, grabbed my hand and she was crying. Wow. And then she made me start crying. And, you know, films are our legacy. So we're very privileged in that sense that this was a collaboration, you know, between myself, between Allison Anders, between Martin Scorsese, who does not produce a lot of female-driven movies. And mm-hmm. I got him to produce this film and my other film, Search and Destroy. And so it means quite a lot to me. And it's my legacy. There's a lot of autobiographical things about my relationship with Marty in the film, about Allison's relationships that she had, and we all had input into the film, and it's all up there on screen, and it's an incredible soundtrack. And, you know, what I look for is just the seamless performances of, you know, Matt Dillon and John Turturro and Eric Stoltz. And it's 80% the movie that I wanted it to be. Mm-hmm. And that's what I always look at, you know. I don't look at my performance. Oh, I wish I had done that better. I look at the movie as a whole.
Yeah.
And I think, my goodness, for the amount of money that we had, you know, $5 million, 30-day shoot, that's not a lot of money. So, you know, we, and it was nominated for a BAFTA. So we, it did very, very well overseas, and it's had this amazing legacy that it is kept, it's kept up. And I'm so much about giving movies a second look that it's, it's ironic that this is a movie that, you know, I feel really deserves a second look because so many people relate to it. And I just, I feel so strongly that if we were able to reinstate a couple of the scenes that were cut out, that we could demonstrate to people that, you know, that it's a bit of a hole in the film. And I still feel that way, you know, much in the way any filmmaker would feel. You want to be able to present the movie that you made in its entirety.
Right.
And in that sense, I disagreed with our executive producer. I will always go for the what the director feels, you know, ultimately.
Yeah.
It's their film. And so, if you know, even though, and I had my own personal feelings, but that's, and if you want to read about the making of the movie, that's also in the book, too. We have some more sort of personal details. But, you know, we've been friends, best friends ever since. And that's what's so amazing in terms of our, you know, of our legacy. Let's talk about other more important things, like the Cats trailer.
The Cats trailer. I'm so, not only am I excited to hear your take, but our guest today, Jason Clark, who's going to be on the show in a little bit, produces very closely with Seth MacFarlane, who's done a lot with CGI.
Of course.
Most
Ted
notably, Ted.
And Stuart Little.
And Stuart Little. So I'm very excited to hear his take, but if you guys don't know, Universal, speaking of, is releasing their big kind of tentpole
Christmas
movie for this year is
Cats.
Adaptation of Andrew Lloyd Webber's musical Cats, one of the highest grossing musicals of all time, making its first sort of cinematic debut. And the trailer has the internet unsettled, is what I'll say.
Well, what's interesting is they, I mean, come on, that looks like a Christopher Guest movie.
It's Taylor Swift. It's this amazing cast. It's interesting. It's Dame Judi Dench, Ian McKellen.
And the costumes are amazing. Now, I am a student of comedy. And so, again, you know what? Here's my take on it. I think long shots are funny.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Peter Bogdanovich says that, too. Long shots are always funnier. You want to see the full body. So, again, in trying to understand why the internet hates this so much, is it because of seeing the full body? Is it because we're seeing, you know, James Corden full body in a cat suit? Is that what is making it funny? Or is it the CGI is maybe not quite up to par? And we're going to ask Jason about this. I don't really know.
I have a couple theories on this.
Okay, what's your theory?
So I hear what you're saying about the physicality of a full body being inherently funny.
Yes.
I think the problem is the scale is very confusing in this trailer.
Okay.
Because sometimes the cats are like a little speck on a giant adult bed.
Yeah.
Sometimes the cats are crawling through a cat door. But then there's a scene where they're in Trafalgar Square.
See, that's funny.
Yeah.
That looks like Spaceballs to me.
It does.
But I have
lot.
To tune in. I'm sorry, this is Ryan
this
in the
is our
booth.
Producer, yeah. Ryan in the booth. Yeah,
that's Dame Judi Dench right there.
Yeah.
That's Judi Dench.
I don't mind actors taking these kinds of roles, though, because
it's
look at
awesome.
Harry Potter and, like, you know, Maggie Smith is wonderful as Professor McGonagall in those movies. You can play fantasy. You can play. I just think it's the combo of the CGI. The scale is very confusing. And honestly, my problem is that Cats has always been bonkers. I think we have this assumption that Cats is this prestigious musical because it's set a very important legacy for Broadway, but the show is crazy. It's about Rum Tum Tugger, the cat, getting resurrected.
Yes.
And so people are acting like it's this hot take to say that Cats is an unsettling property, but it's been weird since 1982.
Well, yeah, there's a whole segment of the population that, you know, thinks musicals and musical comedies are terrible anyway. Like, I love musical comedies.
Yeah, me too.
As soon as it comes out, I can't wait to see it. You know, I want to see it. However, I am going to say there is something slightly off.
Yeah.
About the look of it, and I don't exactly know what it is, and it's not doing itself any favors. Maybe they would have been better off just doing a black screen and just showing the faces.
Here's an example, though. So this is a cat holding silverware, human silverware.
Right.
And it's giant. The knife is almost as tall as the cat.
Yes.
But then later we see them in Trafalgar Square, and they're as big as the lions.
Okay.
So I don't know. The thing is, I actually really trust Tom Hooper. I think he's a great director. I loved the Les Mis adaptation. I think The King's Speech is a wonderful movie. That's another film he did.
Okay, so now this is interesting. Having seen the Broadway version of Les Mis five times, that was my era when I went to New York.
Yeah.
I personally, although I love the performances, and I'm a sucker for musicals anyway. I mean, I loved it. But I have to say, I was not crazy about the intense close-ups that he used in the film. I felt it was a little claustrophobic. And here's the key. Okay, this is what I'm going to say. Mm-hmm. I've seen A Star Is Born with Judy Garland, I would say maybe 50 times. Maybe I've seen it 100 times. It's one of my favorite movies of all time. I've seen Les Mis once.
Mm-hmm.
I saw the Broadway show version five times. So to me, who's a movie lover, you know, how many times have I seen Sweet Charity? Maybe 20 times.
That's fair.
Even Gypsy, the musical, which isn't, you know, my favorite. But some of the more modern musicals I have not seen.
How do you feel about Chicago, the 2003 Renee Zellweger?
I like Chicago. I enjoyed Chicago. I loved La La Land.
Yeah.
You know, if you told me that Damien Chazelle was doing Cats, I think I'd be a lot more excited about it.
Fair enough.
Sorry to say, but
that's totally your opinion. I'll just be very interested to see.
That looks odd.
It's too hard to decide now.
The lighting looks like very strange.
I just think there's no consistent footprint, or should we say paw print, of what the movie's supposed to be.
Yeah.
So we're all just confused. I think right now it's purely confusion. We won't be able to make a judgment till Christmas when we all get the greatest cinematic gift of the year, Hooper's Cats.
Is that the tagline?
That's what I'm taglining it. I think it's going to be incredible just because of what it is. Like, I can't wait to see this movie just because of all the energy around it.
Plus, there's nothing more fun to unite the country than finding a movie to kind of hate like.
Totally. You know? I'm all in. I love to, you know, kind of hate watch a good misstep.
Now,
a good
last
misstep.
Year, what was it? Was it last year, The Greatest Showman?
Yeah.
Which I really enjoyed.
Me too.
And Hugh Jackman is one of my, okay, that's, look at, is that Jennifer Hudson on the right?
Jennifer Hudson on the right. Jane Duty Gench. There's James Corden top left.
Yeah, that's not Jennifer Hudson. That does not. She's a beautiful woman.
I know.
She should look like a beautiful, beautiful cat.
Well, I think she plays the sort of forlorn, disheveled cat, like the former star who sings Memory. We all know that song.
Yes, of course. But that does not. If she looks like that when she's singing Memory, I'm going to call it Betty Buckley.
Well, we'll just have to see. We'll cover it on
the
podcast.
Who's the person on the left? That looks like bad CGI.
She's actually a newcomer. Her name's Francesca Hayward. She was the principal, I think, of the San Francisco Ballet. So she's making her big film debut.
Well, regardless of all of this, I can't wait to see it.
Agreed.
And one of my favorite people to see movies with is my mom.
Oh, yeah.
Because we sit down at Christmas and even though I've seen the movie, I love seeing all the movies with her because she gives it the real Italian. I know within 5 minutes if she's going
to
like it.
Would she want to come on the podcast? Because I would love to do an Oscars recap with her.
With my mom?
Have her call in.
You have to be careful because she might swear a bit. She's Italian. But anyway, and my mom was the one who, you know, she would watch all like Game of Thrones. My mom was the very first person who told me about Game of Thrones.
Wow, good for her.
Back in the day when it first came on. And then I watched it. And I was like, Mom, this is really dirty. Why are you watching this? But she loved Game of Thrones. She's excited about Downton Abbey, you know, all of those films.
Yes.
But anyway, it's fun to hate like.
Yeah.
And speaking of hate like, the other movie that came and went rather quickly was the Charlie's Angels reboot.
Yeah.
And what do you think that was?
You know, I haven't seen it yet, so I don't like to have opinions about movies I haven't seen
it either.
But the kind of controversy around this is the movie didn't perform very well. Elizabeth Banks is quoted as saying it's because it sort of embodies a genre that guys don't like to see. Men don't like to show up for movies, even like hero type movies that don't sort of fit the Wonder Woman sort of sexy female superhero that we're looking for.
Right.
I just don't know if people were clamoring for a Charlie's Angels reboot.
Yeah, that may be it, is that the show, which was, you know, part of my generation, and honestly, I never saw Charlie's Angels because, as I've told the story, we were poor and we didn't have an antenna. Mm-hmm. So we only got one channel, which was CBS.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, look at that, Mike. Oh, my bracelet just broke on the air. So I never saw Charlie's Angels, so I never really got into it. And so I didn't, even when the first one came out with, you know, Bill Murray and Drew Barrymore, even though I liked all those people, I didn't see that version either.
Right.
So now it seems that the people that would even be into Charlie's Angels have no idea who Charlie's Angels are.
I agree.
So I don't know. That, to me, it's just sort of like, why was it made as a movie when somebody like Elizabeth Banks is so talented?
Exactly.
You know, I hope that she, you know, I hope that it doesn't sort of spot her career and make it hard for her to direct other movies. I just think that somebody as talented as she is, it's like, you know, make a, I don't know, there's so many great stories to make that maybe Charlie's Angels wasn't necessarily, you know, it's just as I'm saying it, I don't know if there's a pressure to make a popcorn movie, you know, tentpole movie, so that therefore you can make the smaller film that you want to make. So, you know, are we harder on women than we are on men? Yes, we are,
mm-hmm.
You know. But that being said, I would try to see the film and see, maybe it's a movie that 12-year-old girls would absolutely love. You know?
Yeah, I'm hoping it's the kind of movie that might do better in VOD, airplanes. You know, it's the kind of thing. I'm not necessarily clamoring to see this in the theater, but I would definitely watch it on a flight back to Ohio. You know, it's a nice kind of just turn your brain off a little bit and enjoy a movie like this. So I also love Elizabeth Banks, and I hope producers don't take this as a representation of her talent, because she's a great actress and filmmaker. I like the Pitch Perfect movies.
Oh, they're fantastic.
She's a huge part of that kind of engine, so I'm not worried for her, as long as producers trust her instincts for the future. So
go women, go female directors.
Absolutely.
I'm looking forward to Little Women too.
Oh, me too. Greta. Yeah.
Oh, but we'll be talking about that next week, because there's a slew of films that I'm going to be seeing. Okay, let's get to Jason Clark. Jason Clark is a producer of so many successful films. His early career, that's when he worked with me, was Happy Texas, Hacks, Homegrown, and he transitioned to big budget films like Stuart Little in 1999. And then since then, his filmography is just unbelievable, from Captain Cabin in the Woods to Jackie Robinson to Seth MacFarlane's Ted 1 and 2. And he's was billed on the highest grossing Universal film of 2012. And in addition to becoming the highest grossing original R-rated comedy of all time, he works with Seth MacFarlane and his production company Fuzzy Door. And, I mean, what other films here? A Million Ways to Die in the West, Ted 2, Orville, currently Cosmos. And my goodness, here you are, ladies and gentlemen, Jason Clark. Nice to have you here,
nice
Jason.
To be here. Wow.
First of all, you're way too nice to be a producer. Did anyone ever tell you that?
You are the first person I've never been accused of being nice.
You know, actually, very counterintuitively, that mic does go the other way.
Oh.
It's I know they're the most confusing mics in this business.
How's this?
That's better. Yeah, that'll do the job.
Gotta
fix
that up.
Thank you. I'm really a beginner here.
Well, podcasting is a totally different space, and it's funny because, you know, those vocal mics, to kind of peek behind the curtain for our listeners, I think every single, even very experienced actors will come in here, they always flip those mics around, so you're in good company. They face seemingly the wrong way. But I promise that's the right way.
Maybe we need to label it.
I think we should just don't touch the mic.
All right. Yeah.
There was a terrific show on National Geographic Television, which is called the Breakthrough Prizes.
Mm.
And scientists come up and receive $3 million for their breakthrough inventions. And National Geographic broadcasts it as the Oscars of science. But the scientists, when they confront the microphone, the smartest people in the world, are just stunned. They don't know. Most of them will talk off mic the whole time. You know, and they have to be directed to, this is the microphone. And then they want to touch it and move it all around.
Yeah. So funny. I wonder why that is. You're right. Some of my, sometimes when I'm interviewing people, and it's like, oh, talk into the mic, you know, when I'm doing some of the older people.
I'm in good company is what I'm getting at.
Yes.
These people win scientific prizes and can't figure out the microphone.
I think Rob Schneider definitely came in here. He might have unplugged the microphone.
He broke it? Did he break the mic?
I think so.
He dropped the mic and then he broke the mic.
Yeah, safe space.
Okay, let's get the priorities out of the way. Do you remember, Jason, the first movie you saw and who took you to see it?
You know, it's interesting you ask that question because there's this framed letter that I wrote my dad. I think I was in 1967, believe it or not. So I was probably 5 or 6 years old, and I was practicing my handwriting. And it reads that my Aunt Greta took us to see Snow White. And when I came out of the theater, I found a dollar in a puddle. And now I'm rich. So I would say it was one of those Disney re-releases of Snow White.
That sounds like a letter from a future producer. I found a dollar and I'm rich. You recouped.
Yeah, I recouped immediately on the child's, you know, entry price.
So were you a fan? I mean, because again, people that become film producers, you got to love movies. And again, one of the things about you is like you actually love movies. It's not like you're not talking about, well, our foreign moon, we put this together. Like you love movies. You're a fan of films.
First and foremost, I mean, a huge fan of movies. And like you, to a lesser degree, it runs in the family. My dad's an actor. So,
and who's your dad?
His name is Matt Clark, and he's a character actor, and he's been in a bunch of stuff. He was actually, we share a credit, the three of us share a credit in Hacks, a movie that we did. He plays the bus driver.
That's right.
And in that, and I always tried to put him in little things with Seth. We did a couple things with my dad, too. But so I grew up and visited sets shortly after seeing Snow White because I'd become intrigued and wonder how they... No, it's not because of that. But I would visit sets in the summer with my dad, and it was miraculous. It was like... And one of the things we did is he did a lot of Westerns in the 70s, and I remember being a kid on these Western sets and seeing these towns that would come out of nowhere that were all facade, you know, as they were built in those... And saying, that's the best thing ever. And it stuck with me. And as a teenager, you know, I really fell into the movies. I used to go to the double feature on Wednesdays by myself at the cheap theater. And I would knock out 2 movies a week at the end of their run, so to speak, but still in that kind of almost first run, not yet second run. And
yeah,
I was hooked.
I miss that. That was my childhood, too. The double, you know, for a dollar you'd see.
Yeah.
2 movies seemed pretty good, you know. Even if you didn't, you were like, what the heck is this?
And there was like 2 old ladies that were in the theater, and there was never more than like 25 people, and the sound system sucked, and the projector was probably on low. But for me, it was transformative to go and see all of those incredible movies that were, you know, on television you would see films and you'd discover Preston Sturges or something like that. I remember being a kid and I would go, Preston's, my God, Sullivan's Travels, that's the best movie I've ever seen. And yet, there was no way to recapture it. There was no video. There was no on-demand. There wasn't even, you know, cassette players or anything. So you really, the only way you could go and see these stories was at the movie theater. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the first-run movies, great. They would stay in those theaters for a long time, the Star Wars and the rest, and the Jaws and these movies. But there were all the other movies being made at that time, and you could catch them at a price.
Yeah. I want to go back to the your first on-screen, because it's my mom's favorite movie is Hacks.
Oh, really?
My mother loves this movie.
Are you serious?
She's crazy about this film. And
God, that makes me feel good. That's
a film that, you know, I was talking about the top, DCPs and how a lot of films, if they're not on DCP, they fall out of being watched. Is Hacks... I've got 2 questions. Is Hacks available? Do you know if it's available?
It was available on video. I actually have a print of Hacks, a 35-millimeter print.
Make it DCP.
I'm still very close with Gary Rosen. Mm-hmm. And you know, J.D. Salinger's son, Matt Salinger, produced that with us.
Yes.
And it was a great independent experience, I remember. And you're so fantastic in it. And the entire cast.
It was a labor of love.
It was for all of us.
But so my second question, which I tell people this all the time, is what gave you the inspiration? We didn't have trailers on the set. And so we rented this house, which turned out to be the actor's house, Paul Stewart. And there's a secondary story where I found a letter from Orson Welles. Completely crazy. But what was the inspiration behind not having trailers and being in the house? Because I thought that's what made the film.
Okay.
Was
so,
the chemistry.
I think that the chemistry always helps, regardless of what it is. If the chemistry is toxic, it could play into the film in a positive way. It could invent some tension or crisis. Mm-hmm. If it's lovely, it could play into the film in a way for improvisation and people to feel safe. We had no money. That was our inspiration. So we had a house we could shoot at, which was owned by the director, writer. And we got a good friend, Ralph Boda, who was this incredible director of photography, to shoot it, to help this first-time director through. And we were on a hill behind the Chateau Marmont. It was impossible to park a car, much less a trailer.
Well, I remember the night you made me, I had to drive the Citroën.
Up the hill? Oh, down the hill?
Down the hill. I didn't know how to drive a stick shift. I thought I was going to kill Stephen Ray. We had to go across. Every time I cross Sunset.
Oh, cross Sunset there. Oh, that's hairy.
Yeah, well, you were the producer. Go ahead. Go ahead.
Well, I like to challenge the actors, put them in the... No, that's But we got that house.
Yeah.
It was a house next door. What you were saying, Leon, is that there was the house next door, and sadly, the owner had passed away, and the house had fallen into probate with the Motion Picture Fund that owned it. So they wanted to clean it out and get it ready. And so we asked if we could short-term rent the house for that couple of months while they were still Amazing. Getting it ready to back on the market. And that's where we had set up dressing room. Everybody got a bedroom.
I loved it. And one day, I've told this story many, many times, we had like a little communal area. And it was dear John Ritter and Dave Foley, Richard Kind. And we were all sitting there. And then, you know, in walks Ryan O'Neill with his suit, like over his, you know, like, which curtained off room is mine? And we nicknamed each of our rooms like the Vietnam suite. You know, we really got into it. We thought it was really funny. But I remember Ryan O'Neill came and it was, I always tell the story, like, one day you're on Barry Lyndon and the next day you're looking which curtained room you're.
Yeah, exactly. In some his house that's recently in probate, still with the furniture in it from the previous owners.
Paul Stewart. But the happy news was that they had all these books. They put all these boxes of books out on the street, and I grabbed all the books, and I had a psychic feeling that I told Stephen Ray that I was going to find a letter from Orson Welles, because Paul Stewart had worked with him and was in Citizen Kane, and everybody scoffed at me. And then all of a sudden I pulled out this letter.
I remember.
And it was it flew in the air, and it was a letter.
Wow. And Hacks was about the tenor of the storytelling, or what the story is about, is about people trying to make their way as storytellers in Hollywood. And here we are behind the Chateau Marmont. The story references the Chateau Marmont mm-hmm. in a very specific way. And Ileana has a letter from Orson Welles, who's trying to make A Touch of Evil? Or what film was it?
It was the last movie, the one that finally got made, the one, The Wind.
It recently was finished by somebody else. Yeah. It was his kind of unfinished.
Other Side of the Wind.
Other Side of the Wind. And he had been working on it for years. And the letter was talking about things that we were dealing with.
Yeah.
Like, I know I didn't have the money, but now I have the money and we can finish the shoot now. And Paul, please stay with me.
Yeah, stay with me, and I hope you still have the suit
Wow.
that we shot with.
Brian O'Neill walked in with that suit.
It shows how universal the filmmaking experience is, right? Whether it's $200 million or it's, you know, $20,000, there's something kind of like vital and universal that ties every filmmaker together or film set.
You know, I think, you know, part of my job as a producer, sure, is to manage a budget, a schedule, and the creative process, and to reach consensus, and kind of, but also it's to allow a point of view to be found in each of those stories. Mm. So if you're making a picture for $200 million, you still have to find that point of view. And that's at the core of the filmmaker's job. And you still have to protect, if you're part of the team, that point of view. And it's the same if you're making a $20,000 movie. So, you know, there's a lot to learn about the politic of filmmaking. And, you know, Liana, you've worked with everyone. So you know there's different skill sets that you have to apply to get to manage that process. But ultimately, having been in charge of a lot of movies, it's really exciting to be able to see that point of view emerge and to protect for it.
I go back to the same thing, which, you know, then I'm going to talk about the next movie we're on, Happy Texas, which was an even tighter schedule. And yet, once again, the atmosphere, I say all the time, it's the atmosphere on the set creates whether, for me, you can't act in a state of fear, I don't think.
Yeah.
Fear or chaos. If you create an atmosphere that's fun and collaborative, you want to go to work and do your best and be part of a team, you know. And Happy Texas had that same, you know, again, quality. And I think, again, this to me is the height of the independent film movement.
Yeah, for me too. It was a period.
How many days did we do? It was like crazy, like 17 days.
18 or 20 days or something like that. And, you know, Happy Texas. So I got the script and I met with the director and the writer, and they said, we're going to make this for $4 million in Texas. And it'd been sitting for a year and it hadn't been made. So I said to them, well, first of all, we'll make it in, here's my pitch to you guys. We'll make it in Los Angeles. We'll make it for $1.5 million and we can start making it right now. Cause I can tell you right now, we're going to find that money. And they became incensed with the whole idea. And they went home and they said, but we could be making our movie. But there's hills in L.A. and there's no hills in Texas. It's flat. And they had all their kind of preconceived notions. But they worked through all of those notions and they came back. And I said, just give me 2 weeks. Let me see what I can do. And that's how we made the movie. And it was an incredible experience of letting go of what you thought you needed. Mm. And therefore, you were like a passenger waiting in a train station for a train to pick you up, that money train to come by and pick you up. And it turned more into we were the moving train, jump on board. And I think that permeated on the set. Even though we had no money, it was fun. Everybody was there for the right reason.
It was a blast. And it was quick. I mean, again, but again, because we knew it was quick, you know, everybody, it was all hands on deck all the time. And it's just so interesting to me because subsequently I've been on movies that are no money and they feel like, oh, it's no money. You just have to suffer. You know, like they make everything in, like that's, it doesn't have to be that way. Just because you have no money, that's why I use the example of the house, is that so many times as an actor, I get frustrated because I know that there's a better way to produce.
Yeah.
You know, that the ultimate goal isn't just like to be the money guy and cut corners. There's a way to utilize the budget, but to create an atmosphere where you get the most out of your actors because you only have a certain amount of time with them.
And it's worth mentioning that Happy Texas went on and was an audience, won an audience award at Sundance and sold for a record price that held for over 10 years. We made it for $1.25 million and we sold it for $10.25 million. And everybody got paid. The sound guy bought himself a new Volvo.
I remember. And it was a good year that was.
Yeah, that was such a great year that this check came in.
Never happened again. I said, because every time you do a movie, you're like, yeah, I know. I have a piece of the back end. And never do. But
Harvey Weinstein flew in. Cassian Elwes and myself went up to the Stein Erickson. We put Mark and Ilsley, who was our writer-director, and Ed Stone, who was the writer-producer, in a like Denny's. Wait here, guys. We'll see. And we negotiated this deal all night. We were abandoned by all of our players. Like our lawyer said, my wife told me I have to go home. I have to leave tonight. And so we were like negotiating, and Harvey would come out of the bedroom smoking, going, you know, and kind of say, and Mark Gillen, and we crafted the press release and did the deal. And we came out and was like, is this real? And it was great. And unfortunately, they did a terrible job of releasing the movie.
Yeah.
I would say that. But it is a great movie. It is one of the great.
It really is. And again, it's funny. We seem to be on the same circular topic today. There was a cut I saw of the film, you know, that was at Sundance. And then subsequently it got recut. And it was not as good. It was still good, and people still love the film, but it lost some of that homegrown indie
vibe. Yeah,
vibe of the fun that we had in making it, and the looseness, you know, that we had. And
I love that you related to that in that way. That's because. You know, that was one of our ambitions, is to make it fun.
I was the first one to join it. I think I was the very first actor. I was like, I'm in. I said, I don't know when you're going to get the money, but I'm in.
I remember
and
that.
And I actually suggested Steve Zahn, who I knew a little bit from New York.
Yeah.
And they had never heard it, you know, because he hadn't been in a movie except for Reality Bites, which wasn't out yet. And what happened to his career? No. it was a lot of fun. Okay, so very briefly, then you worked with our hometown favorite here, Billy Bob Thornton, on Homegrown. These are all your indie movies before you get to Stuart Little. And what did you learn from these, like, indies?
Well, I started even before that doing independent film. Then I left that and ended up in the independent world making Van Damme movies. So I made 3 Jean-Claude Van Damme movies in a row after making 2 Dolph Lundgren movies in a row.
Wow.
So I was on this action trajectory, and I traveled the world. It was one of the most remarkable times, and at a different time, there's plenty of stories from that. All of which worth repeating and amazing. But at the end of that experience of doing that, I really wanted to make stories I cared about. And so I reached out into the independent world. I think what I learned is that I wanted to be able to finance these movies. I wanted them to find their way a little bit. It was really hard. I mean, on Hacks, I got paid $1 up front. On Happy Texas. So it was literally like a money-losing venture. I had young kids, and eventually I had to say, I need to work at, and make money and do this. You know, I'm not independently wealthy. I think I learned that, you know, the process of making film is about engaging people creatively and creating, as a producer, an environment that they can be creative regardless of the limitations. So I think I was more prepared when there was more money to feel secure that it's not about that. I didn't really feel that it was. I thought it was about more like, what's the story that we're trying to tell? How do we support that? What's the best people to do that? Why are they here? Are they here for the reason? You know, I remember arguing with unions and Teamsters and saying, look, you guys, you're trying to make your rate. I don't care if you make your rate or not. Honestly, I'm just trying to make my art. That's right. What we're here for. So if I can pay you, I'll pay you every dollar I have. But if I don't have more, I don't have more. I understand that may not fit with your model, but what I'm here is for that creative vision. Mm. And I think that, you know, you get bigger and you get more complicated and you need more stage space, or you need higher priced actors, or you need all that. It gives you a point of view when you negotiate to be able to say to people, let's make sure we're still here for the right reason.
So how did you then get involved? You said you had this, you know, the background with doing Jean-Claude Van Damme movies. So how did that make you the right producer for Stuart Little? Were you a fan of the books? First of all,
super fan of the books.
Yeah.
It was really weird.
You had kids.
I had kids. So I was in the... But it was the one book that my mother read to me that I remembered. And, you know, it wasn't the other E.B. White stuff. So, and she was an English major. So I always held it kind of a little bit more dear, and I remember the pictures were so remarkable to me. Because when you're a kid and being read to, you're really studying those pictures and going into them. And I can't remember the name of the artist, but so when the opportunity arose to do that, it was with a director named Rob Minkoff, who had directed The Lion King, and he and I had been hired by Columbia Pictures to try to put together a version of Into the Woods. And I had this fabulous experience with all these really great artists, and my job was to try to figure out how to do it for a better price. And we did, but it wasn't enough, and they passed on it. But I had this great collaboration with Rob. So when Stuart Little, the studio, I think, felt it was like, oh, what's hard about this? It's just a guy and a mount. It's like a family in a house. It looked a lot less complicated on paper.
Right.
Because you just read Stuart as a character, not as a 4-inch character. And nobody had ever done it before. And I was excited by that. I felt it was like, let's try to do something they haven't done before. So when Rob engaged on it, and he said, look, if I do this, are you going to do it? I said, yeah, let's do this. So we worked with a producer named Doug Wick. I don't know if you know who Doug Wick
yes.
is.
Mm-hmm.
We worked with Doug Wick, who had at that point the rights through Waterman and a couple of other producers who were the rights holders. And we quickly realized that it was a beautiful script, but for 60 pages, nothing happened. There was no action in the storytelling. And so we were desperate to kind of figure that out as we were figuring out the model. And nobody knew how to create CGI fur. ImageWorks was brand new at the time and burgeoning, but felt that they had a skill set that they were even not prepared for. We drew in a tremendous amount of animation talent who understood the kind of Disney emotional performance versus the CGI only, you know. So there was the technologists versus the artists, mm-hmm. where I employed that skill set of what's the point of view and who has the artistic point of view, regardless of all the technology and money that you can build around it. And I was able to help manage that process to discover, you know, how to create this. And the technology did brilliant work, but also the performance, I thought, of the mouse was so incredible. And it cost a lot more. It was much harder than anybody expected along the way. Not that we weren't budgeted appropriately, because we were, but mm-hmm. I think when they first saw the script, it seemed like, well, this is relatively a contained movie.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting when you think of sometimes the first approach, you know, like I was thinking as you were talking, the first approach when they did the movie The Elephant Man, and they had never done that kind of mega before, and they failed and failed, and then they finally got it right, and then when they got it right, that became the definition of, okay, we think we understand this. And it sounds like when you're talking about, again, getting that stop motion right, that first attempt, even though, as we were talking about at the top of the movie, still some movies don't quite get it right.
Yeah, it's we didn't have any preconceived process.
Yeah.
And there was no 1.0 to 2.0. So we went into the movie you know, we watched Indian in the Cupboard. And we said, yeah, well, that's a little dude. So basically, a little dude shot with overscale props around him.
Yeah.
None of the depth of field made sense. So it always felt like this dude's in another room, and he's talking to this person who's supposed to be sitting right next to him. So we said, well, how do we get around that? So we have to expose things. So we came up with, we wanted to do this with CGI. But how do the actors act against the empty space, as Gina Davis called it? You know, she always had an empty space to work with, and kind of planning that out so it didn't affect her performance in a negative way.
Yes.
But she felt like there was a character in the room, so we brought an on-set voice. We used eyeline tools that were synced with the shutter. And once we had the set figured out, then we went to the visual effects company, and they said, let the technologists handle it. They can build you a robot that looks like a real character. And, you know, I'm joking, but the reality is it doesn't matter how good it looks if it acts terribly. Mm-hmm. And so I explained to them, this is the movie star, and we're going to spend millions to use this movie star. And a voice is not a performance. A performance is all of it contained in this character. So you guys have to think about it differently. And then we went into character design. And how much did it look like a real mouse, or and how much was anthropomorphized, and what was the inspiration? And so those three things had to be triangulated. And we had a guy, and I remember him working for months on the design, and he started to make the changes we said. But the changes we said were caveated by, we need to make a computer. But and they, well, what does that mean? Well, maybe eyes further apart and the nose. And he would make the eyes further apart and the nose. And I went, it's not cuter. It's uglier. And then we hired another guy after weeks and weeks. Was another guy who came from Pixar and he used to do sculpting. And 1 week later, we looked at it and said, that's it. It's perfect.
Wow.
That's so interesting. It's like the developing Mickey Mouse, you know, the different, you finally get the eyes.
And you get the right artist on it. And all of a sudden, it resolves problems that are, you know, you can't talk through. It's hard to articulate.
It's interesting because then when I was sort of doing my research on you, this is the secret of why then Ted is so good, because I didn't realize. I said, oh, he's not in a booth, because again, some of these films that don't exactly where I'm like, I like it, but I don't feel emotionally invested. Yes. It's because they're in the booth doing the voice. And so you were saying, so what I was reading was that in Ted, he's there, he's acting with the person. And you said, again, getting the eye lines right. And I don't think people necessarily did that before. So discuss that a little bit. And did you know that going in that that's what you were going to do on Ted?
Totally. You know,
Ted, other people should employ that then.
Yes. It's
it, Ted like is, it would be cheaper in the end.
It there's so many unwritten benefits to it. But first of all, there hasn't been a lot of R-rated comedy starring CG characters.
You don't say.
You know, so it's not exactly a science.
It's really a revelation.
Yeah, and R-rated comedies are not budgeted like family four-quadrant films, so we had to figure out how to do it cheaper, better, and not step on the neck of improvisational acting within it, even though, you know, the script is very beautifully scripted and we stayed within the rules of that. There's still a repartee, a performance piece that happens with two people in a room acting against each other that doesn't happen when you don't have that. So we had to figure out how to capture movement when Seth was giving his lines. He was also directing the movie. So we had to figure out how he could direct the movie, give his lines, and capture his movement at the same time. And we actually captured all three of those things. That was before we knew the character. But as we discovered the character, we realized, well, we don't need to capture his movement. We know how he's going to move because our incredible artist who created his performance from that already knew where the shrugs were and what gestures Seth would throw in. So just a bit of reference was enough to kind of give them the right direction. But for the other actors, if I tell you to look somewhere and pretend that someone's there, nobody's better in the world than an actor at playing to something like that.
Right.
You know, because they're used to performing and getting rid of the artifice of the of whatever the situation is and being there. But you know, Seth would be off camera and he would deliver those lines and Mark would perform to the empty chair where Ted was supposed to be and they would have interaction and a guy with a blue glove would grab, you know, the bong from Mark, like get past it to Ted and take it out of the scene or and then pass it back. And when it all came together, it was brilliant.
Is there any when you're in the zone like that, because initially when you're starting, is there any sort of cringe factor of like, okay, we just got to get into this? Of because I'm sure that the initial part must be challenging. You know, you're hearing an off-screen voice. Where do you look? Is that all a technical challenge?
Yeah.
Your tendency is to move from your eye line and look at the direction. You know.
If I was to kind of like give you all of the like little pieces of it.
But then you hit it and you go.
We made a stuffy and he was Ted's size.
Uh-huh.
And so this guy would stand on set, this stuffed teddy bear, and the camera would line up against him. Then we gave
the light to him.
Yeah, light to him. His fur. We tried to match him exactly. Yeah. We said, you know, it was a chicken and egg. Is the CG guy first, and then we make the other. Said, no, let's make the real one and make it match. The CG guys match that because it exists. And then we sent him one. Here, take this Ted and make it look like this. But we would do that. And then when we do rehearsal, the blocking rehearsal, the actual visual effects animation guy, he would walk Ted around and have him get onto the cat. So you knew how long it took him to walk across the room. Mm-hmm. So you as an actor would follow the doll. And you go, oh, that's how the doll goes. And then we'd do a couple takes of rehearsal like that. Then we'd shoot what we call the stuffy pass, which was just with the guy puppeting this puppet through. And we'd actually film with that. So everybody was on their game. They were 100% ready, with the exception of there was a guy standing behind this, you know, this toy and doing this. And it locked everybody in. Mm. And then we just took that toy out. And the next, you know, we took the stuffy out. And then it was all kind of clear. And we had eyeline tools. So if he was sitting in a chair, you'd know where his eyes are versus, you know, the other thing. And we put that in there. It had a little couple of gray balls at the end of like a car antenna.
What about some of the crazy scenes, like the fight scenes and things? I mean,
that we did a stunt fist. So we built a fake room. I remember building it out of like plywood and cardboard with furniture in it and a ceiling fan. And the guy went in for a day with their stuntmen and our Mark Double, who was this incredibly talented stunt guy, and our stunt coordinator, Scott Robertson, or Scott, not Robertson, Scott, and our, and a stuffy, and one of those stuffed bears. And they had a huge knockdown drag out, and they shot it on video, and we cut it together, and we looked at it all so we could know this is, we called it stunt viz as opposed to previz. Mm. And we went and shot it shot for shot. It was perfect. And the net result was, I mean, we made some modifications. Seth had a lot of notes, and we made modifications on it.
Yeah.
But when we got a cut to the what he liked, at the end of the day, we just recreated it now with the full effect.
Is it hard, though? It's like the premise. Part of the reason I love Ted is just because on premise alone, it's already so funny. But at a certain point, you have to enter into the earnestness of the storytelling and buy the fact that this is a real relationship. So, you know, when you're doing a fight scene like that, do you feel like you need one take just to get the laughs out and then you can do the work, or are you able to do the work right away?
No, you do the work right away. We did it in continuity because we're wrecking the room as we go through. Mm-hmm. So as we smash stuff and break stuff and whatever, just so everybody can keep track. And certainly Mark is going to get more and more disheveled during the course of it. No, the artifice of it is not – it doesn't – it goes away day one of filming.
Yeah.
And you're on day 46 or whatever you are in a small room like the one we're in here, and a guy, a stuntman and camera and the rest of us, and a guy's fighting the empty space. That's great. We built a you know what we did do? We made a little belly out of that same stuffy material that we had a match. And that way Mark could wrestle with that. He would have that, and he would hold it between his hands, and then we'd put Ted on that. And he had arms, he'd punch him in the face. And so that was all CG, and Mark was reacting to that. It was really fun.
I'm sure.
Yeah.
I want to talk about the casting of Mark Wahlberg. Again, he does not get enough credit for what a challenge that is to make that relationship, you know, real and funny and make it seem like a guy from Massachusetts. And it's just astonishing to me because, again, like you said, he's not acting to anything. He's got to commit to the point that you're looking around on the set going, okay, does he really think that that's a real, you know, like, you know, your worry is, did you worry for his sanity at some points? You know, you're like, okay, that was so good.
He was perfect.
To worry.
He was brilliant.
He's got to buy it 150% or we don't buy it. Mm-hmm. And that's what I meant.
You know, it's a great point you bring up, and he did. But part of Seth's real concept with the movie, he told me, is that I want to make sure we don't have too many elements of fantasy on fantasy. Mm. So if you have this teddy bear that came to life 30 years ago and now nobody really gives a shit, then if that's your premise of your movie, where it's set, and he had said it when he wrote the script in Boston. And so we knew immediately we had to shoot in Boston because the environment made sense. It's kind of a small city. It's perfect. You could believe that if there was a child star who had, you know, years of fame for 10 years, mm-hmm. 30 years later, everybody in Boston would know, but nobody really give a shit. They would be, hey, Ted, what's happening? You know, so you yell from the car in front of a grocery store or something. And we had a few of those, but generally people did not, you know, it's 30 years, 25 years later. He's no longer the star that he was, so to speak. So, being in Boston gave an authenticity to all the choices that were made creatively on the film to be in that world. And needless to say, Mark is from Boston. So it was like...
Was he your first choice?
Yes. I mean, I know that there was a time before that when we were casting the movie that other ideas had come and go, but it was almost like, in retrospect, it's like, how could you ever think of anybody else? Mm. And, you know, he's an action star. He's not exactly a lays about kind of guy. But he also played perfectly with the romantic story of him being kind of held back by this, you know, kind of screwed up friend who was the star of their relationship when they were kids.
Yeah.
And now Mark is ready to move on. He's good looking. He's got Mila Kunis in his life, and she's amazing. And he's being pulled in that direction, and Ted's kind of holding him back.
I also want to talk briefly about how well the women are always portrayed in these films. Like, they're not just the sideline pretty girlfriends. They're always a part of the action, and they're very funny and, you know, fully rounded characters. And so my question is that...
That's really nice of you to say. I know that Seth works really hard to identify a world like that.
Do you think that that's part... Then I'm going to switch it up by saying, is this part of a New England sensibility that he may have that he introduces into the script? Because New England women are funny. There's a very specific kind of New England humor, I think. No nonsense-y.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know. I think it's... I've really given it a tremendous amount of thought.
The women are very appealing.
Completely,
you know?
Yeah. And they're educated, and they're part of the storytelling, and they're not treated like... I mean, in that particular story, there's a real rooting interest for Mark and Mila to end up together.
Yeah.
You're just hoping they end up together. It's maybe the strongest rooting interest of the movie.
Yeah.
And she's kind of fantastic and has this kind of knucklehead boss that she's got handled.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? She's not running to him saying, help me. She's kind of like dealing with a world where she says, you know, to Mark's character, you have to grow up, John, and, you know, we have to be together, and you mm-hmm. have to let go of your teddy bear and your childhood. And I think coming from that, certainly from that New England voice, there's Jessica Barth, who's a brilliant actress, played Ted's girlfriend. Mm-hmm. And she actually in the sequel, she plays Ted's wife. And they have this scene that is very reminiscent of Raging Bull, the fight between the husband and wife in Raging Bull.
Yeah, there's a lot of like movie, you know, trivia that sort of he obviously seems like he's a big movie fan.
Yeah.
Movie fanatic. The other thing I was going to ask is just in terms of what were any inherent problems on this? Again, that seems like a movie where everybody just was laughing all the time. Like you sense that feel good vibe when you're watching it. The decision to set it in Boston, I think, is grounds the movie. Number one, I'm not sure why. But sometimes comedies that are in an unspecific location, I find less funny.
Yeah.
You know, because I there's something inherently funny to me about Boston already.
Already. It's a city where it also feels that loyalty is so important to everyone. Mm. And this is a story about loyalty.
Right.
You know, we've been best friends for life. Are we still best friends? It's a city where... the upper echelon of the city, the sports stars, seem to have a relationship with everyone in the city. So you could run into them at a night. It's small enough you could run into them at a nightclub. So a lot of people would talk to you about, like, my friend who's like on the, you know, the winning hockey team, won the Stanley Cup. People run into each other in Boston. So it's a small place. So a guy like Ted, you could see, you know, people. Yeah. Oh, last night we're out. Yeah, Ted was there. He's always there. You know. It felt like a place where the story could
be believable.
Yeah.
Do you think it's as close to like a guy weepy type of movie? Because there's so few movies that men can actually get emotional about. And again, that's one of the astonishing things about the movie is you find yourself getting emotional about their relationship.
It's a bromantic comedy, I think.
Yeah.
There's two...
That's what put it over the top, I think, that makes
the
it...
The bromance.
Yeah.
There's this great scene at the end of the movie, and spoiler alert, where something tragic happens to Ted, and Mark and Mila have to pick him up. It's at Fenway. which was great. We got to shoot at Fenway, which is, you know, when you're in Boston, you get to knock out all the big plate like that. Oh, yeah, we're shooting. But we've got Fenway. And then, of course, you get invited to the game, the Red Sox game, in the owner's box. Yeah, that's where, you know.
Nice.
But we shot there, and he gets dismantled, is the best way to say it, our doll. And I got a call from the head of post, a woman who was the head of post at the studio. And she said, I saw the dailies. I was crying. And I said, you can't make my day any better than what you just did. Because, you know, you hope there's tragedy. It's a silly comedy. But she believed so much, just through the dailies with that stupid stuffy, so to speak, that she was so invested in the idea that it made her cry, that something tragic had happened to this character. And I was like, nailed it.
Was that something that was in the script, too? Yeah. Okay, so then it was there from the beginning.
This is all McFarlane's vision, and, you know, he's a genius. And working with Seth was one of the, or has been on multiple occasions, one of the greatest experiences of my life, because he's very specific but very generous with his collaborators. So it's very interesting. He knows kind of what he wants, and he comes from animation, and I discover a lot of times animation people have an ability to kind of visualize in three dimensions in a way that's kind of interesting. So if you apply that to a storyteller like Seth, and then you give him 300 hours of television or whatever he's done at this point in his career, so he's told 300 stories and seen the results of package, putting it together, spending a year working on seeing out. He's so skilled, and he doesn't wear that as a way to. I mean, anybody with an idea, he's so generous with them, whoever they are, that it gives people kind of a safe place to have those ideas.
When going into the sequel is just the number one idea to make it funnier, or what is, you know, when you're going to do a sequel. Well, first of all, did you want to do a sequel? Was that a part of it, or was it a surprise that the movie did?
Yeah, it was. I was doing a movie called 42, and we were shooting in Atlanta, and I got the call, well, hey, we're exceeding the numbers, or whatever, on that Friday. And you get those calls, and it can go either way on Friday. It can be, there are no, I wish I had good news. You know, those calls are like, oh, God. You know, but like, I was on East Coast time. We're getting material, and the projections got better and better. And then we ended up having a very big weekend, almost double what they had originally thought we would do. And it went out to be very successful. So immediately, you know, the studio and everybody said, we really want to do a sequel. This is perfect for us to do another one. And I think we were already on a trajectory or path to do something else. Mm-hmm. So it was a little bit like, and I think for Seth, it was like creatively, it was visiting something that he was obviously excited to do, and he loves it, but he also had something he wanted to do first. And so we went off and made A Million Ways to Die in the West, which is a comedy Western that he has always wanted to do. But I think, you know, making, I don't think that was part of his intention in the beginning. And I bet he'll at some point turn his attention to a third one, because Ted is such an incredible character that he's created. He deserves another movie, and Mark is so brilliant.
We need some Ted right now.
Yeah.
Do you find the climate, again, it also feels like comedies work in the right climate, and currently the climate feels so tense.
Oh, it's tough.
I don't know if even people want a comedy, you know.
From my point of view, it's been, you know, it's been a rough few years here, and we're on year three of this. And I think, you know, the times have yielded probably have exposed a lot of ills that are out there. But they also have, people haven't been ready to laugh, and they haven't been really interested in funny. So you see a lot of good comedies that are either shut down because they push the border, or push the line. You know, stepping over the line is part of, I think, comedy for me. I love to laugh at things that are almost beyond the pale of what's acceptable, because it's a way for us to process that. And I don't know, times, it seems like we've been watching a comedy in the White House, and we can't get by thinking, it can't get it. That can't be real. Sorry.
Well, it's like when you're in the mood for certain films, you know, and there was an era of film noir and there was an era of screwball comedy. You know, my grandfather always said coming back from World War II, the climate to do funny, frothy comedies, it was over, you know, so it was very serious minded films for a very long time. And it seems like movies today, I feel like we're slightly, even though we desperately need comedies, it seems like the bar seems to be so highly raised. There's been a number of comedies that I've watched on Netflix that just didn't get good releases, but that are very, very funny. And I wonder why they didn't do well.
And you look at it and you say, well, the superhero genre is stronger than it's ever been. The horror genre is stronger than it's ever been. Mm-hmm. You know, horror may be perennial, maybe always, but and maybe some, you know, it's a very interesting comment that you just made. And it is about, the timing and what people...
Well, because I was watching, you know, I wanted to watch the movie last night, A Million Ways to Die in the West. So I hadn't seen it. I wasn't even aware of it. And it's like, that's what I'm... And there's been a lot of comedy films that I've watched after the fact and that I think they're very funny. But I think that when initially they come out, which is not fair, but I'm sort of thinking that people... There's a sort of a so what comedy... feeling about comedy.
Yeah.
As if it's not difficult. And it's very difficult. Totally. And especially when somebody makes it seem effortless. It's like, oh, yeah, it's another Adam Sandler comedy. You know, it's like, but they're very hard. To make and to make people laugh.
That was a discovery for me. You know, it's funny because action was like, oh, that must be hard. No, not really. It's really fun. It's dangerous. You have to be very careful about it.
Yeah.
But it also it's constructed very specifically, and it's really part of it leans into the filmmaking more than the storytelling.
Mm-hmm.
And comedy is kind of like it has to, you know, good comedy has to have a great premise, but also it leans into the storytelling.
Yeah.
You know, if the jokes aren't aligned with the story, it doesn't work. But if the jokes are aligned with the story and the characters, then it, you know, comes to life.
I was just in Tucson, Arizona. So I was in Tombstone and the old, you know, they actually shot a lot of Westerns there. And I actually love Westerns anyway. And God, the life of some of these people was so unbelievable and crazy. I mean, you have to understand, I guess, the Westerns, you know, to maybe satirize them a bit. But were you a Western fan?
Well, yeah. I mean, my dad was in so many of them.
Yeah.
I remember being in, you say Tucson, I remember everybody stayed at the Desert Inn. I was probably 11 or 12 years old. Every night, everybody gathered at the pool deck, and there was Lee Marvin and all of these kind of great Jack Palance.
He lived in Tucson.
He did. Yeah. He did. And everybody drank really heavy. And I remember Michelle Marvin, this was before the great Palamoni case of whatever that was, the 70s. Michelle would take us, me and my brother, down to Thrifty's and get the 5-cent ice creams at Thrifty. Oh. But I was enamored by the Western sets. And so when Seth said he wanted to do a Western, I was like, I'm all in. And all you could think is, well, it's one town and, you know, it's a bunch of actors and we have some animals, but it should be simple. It was one of the hardest things I've ever done. Mm.
Well, I was going to say, working with animals, and it's not like the old days. You know, in the old days, they'd have a ranch, and everybody would have their horse and
care of your own horse.
Yeah. Nowadays, it's like you need a wrangler, and I'm sure, you know, just to get a chicken, I'm sure.
I mean, there was a great memory from A Million Ways to Die in the West. We shot in primarily in Santa Fe, New Mexico. And then we went to Monument Valley on it and shot there, which was amazing, and a few other great kind of like iconic locations. I remember being at John Ford Rock and in Monument Valley, and we're filming on this rock and we had all of our equipment and people, and we see off way in the distance this like storm coming at us. And this is to what's so difficult about shooting. Westerns are all outside.
Mm.
You don't realize that until you make one.
I love
but
it.
You have like 10 minutes of filming in a jail cell and like 40 days in the elements in the high desert. And this thing's coming at us, and it's like a dust devil kind of thing. And it's literally a microburst of weather. And you're there with your locals, and the locals are,
well, we better take down the stuff because this thing's coming at us. And you do, and all of a sudden you're in 70-mile-an-hour winds. It's raining. The tent got ripped off the thing. The guy's hanging on to the camera so it doesn't fall off John Fort Rock. 5 minutes later, it's gone.
Wow.
And you go, what in the fuck
so
was that?
So funny.
And that is what making a Western is like, because you never know. You're out in the elements so all the time.
Yeah, I never thought of it.
Yeah.
I guess that probably helped the movie. That's so the premise of the movie, too, right? So maybe did that help fuel some creative energy on set, do you feel?
Definitely felt like it was a million ways to die.
Yeah.
I'm making this Western. We had second to last day of filming. These grade alls, which are these amazing vehicles that you use on sets to like block sunlight exterior and stuff like that. You can't knock these things over. They're like perfect. So some guy's driving it. It falls over.
Oh my gosh!
And it falls over like a 60-foot boom arm, and it comes swinging down where the guy is de-rigging the $1 million camera crane and the $300,000 camera. And he looks up and goes, and he takes like 3 steps back, and it lands right on the camera and crushes the camera and the crane. And it was some kind of microburst. He had to raise his arm to get above the trees, and the wind caught whatever he had in there and knocked this thing that never supposed to come over. So you never knew where it was coming from. So you had this kind of like dynamic environment. And thank God everybody, I mean, we didn't really have any real problem. We had a flood. We had one scene, we got rained out 3 times in a row. And at one point I had to go in. I remember going into Charlotte's room, soaking wet into her trailer. I go, and she's flown in specifically. We're going to get this shot. Tonight's the night. And as the plane is landing, we see the microbursts of the lightning on the horizon.
I go, yeah.
No, it's not coming to us, is it? Anyhow, we get set up. This is after take one got shot down by rain. We're back 2 weeks later, and this rainstorm comes in, and it is so bad that I have to evacuate the set, or we could have been stuck there.
Wow.
So I've got everybody. So I come in drenching wet after saying to her, oh, it'll rain. It'll end in 20 minutes. We'll be back out. Don't worry. It's great. The ground absorbs the water. There'll be no puddles. We'll just shoot. And now I get in a trailer and says, we have to leave. And she laughs. And she goes, right now.
Wow.
You have to get in your car right now before the road washed out.
Crazy.
Yeah. That's amazing. So as a producer, when you make that long walk to the, because whenever a producer comes to a trailer, I get very nervous.
Something's
it's
bad.
It's never good news. So what are your what is the worst things that happened to a producer that you have to handle?
Well, we were doing Ted, and somebody told me I have to go tell Mark Wahlberg to cut his hair. And I was like,
Why is it?
I'm teasing, but there was no way. And then Mark told me a story of doing The Departed, and how they had to go back and do reshoots.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, "I'm not cutting my hair." I think he's always booked on another job, and he's like, "The hair is for the next job."
Yeah.
And so finally, I had to go in there. He says, "Hey, come here." He comes in, takes me back. So he starts trimming. I mean, literally. 3 little strands of hair come on. He's got his hairstylist cut. So he tell him you cut. Look, I cut my hair. I said, no, we're talking about 2 inches we have to take off of your hair. So if you watch Ted carefully.
Oh, those are the, But what techniques do you? Now, I know you box a little. Does that help you in your producing?
For the hours.
You seem so, you're so unadversarial. You have such a nice way about you. And so I can't.
That's very sweet of you to say that.
I know. That's why I can't imagine.
There's a lot of people who could have the.
I can't imagine you get anything done. You're way too nice. But again, so what, again, when you employ these, do you send over coffees to people? When you're asking people to do these things with delays or they have to come back for reshoots, what kind of.
Well, I get a little money in the bank for trying to take care of them. So, when
send
I come
him,
and ask for
send
a favor.
Send him a puppy?
When I ask for a favor, I say, hey, we've taken, can you help me out?
Oh, so you do that.
A little bit. And, there's some hard calls that you have to make.
Yeah.
With things that happen. And generally, if you've been on the right side of the decision making, you're in good.
Yeah.
You're in good company as opposed to people. You know, so I mean,
those niceties. Maybe I'm just on the wrong movies, though. But a lot of those niceties seem to have not on the movie. I feel like I remember in the old days, it'd be a nice gift basket, the trailer, maybe a blanket or something. You know,
there's no more gifts for anybody. Yeah, there's no budget for anything. Everything's been cut.
Yeah, more. You know, they're always trying to make you fly coach, or it's only an hour flight. Like,
well, you talk about those westerns. I remember being on the set. My dad had a honey wagon room, which is the size of a couch. That's the entire room. So did everybody else. Mm. And maybe if you're Lee Marvin, you had a double honey wagon room. You know?
Yeah.
This was before all these trailers. Now you go and there's a village that chases around, like on a TV show or something.
Yeah.
And everybody has this kind of measuring contest of what trailer they have and the rest of that stuff. And it's such a distraction.
And is it expensive to have a lot of trailers and stuff?
It's only that you have to move them.
Yeah.
Now you have to pay a team of guys with trucks to move all those. And, you know, those are not exactly trucks that are moving the equipment or doing. So you don't feel the value of of that towards like what you would feel if you were actually needed a piece of equipment. You know,
So one of the, I don't know if you have an answer, but if you could answer, what do you think the hardest part of producing a movie is?
You know, there's probably stages of it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's the development and creation and financing of a movie, which is in and of itself has a lot of hard parts. And then there's the making of the movie, which will always have challenges that are there. And then there's the editing and release and marketing and all of that stuff. And I think maintaining an understanding of what it is you're setting out to do through all of that and trying to deal with each of these specific phases with as much of an open mind and open ideas.
Right.
You know, that's hard to do because you can become scared of, you know.
Well, it's like a runaway train.
Yeah. And you don't know what may have made you laugh on the page may not make you laugh when you see it shot.
Mm-hmm.
And then what you thought was kind of like chuffa throughout all of a sudden is the best scene in the movie for you. I've had those experiences. You know, I know when we did Stuart Little, and I'm just going to, one quick aside, we had a boat race scene, which is at the end of the movie, and the toy boat race scene. There's no Stuart, there's just toy boats. And we shot it was so complicated. And we shot these toy boats, and we flooded the parking lot at Paramount and painted sky backing in the Paramount. And we shot at Paramount for a month, second unit, these toy boats that would list to the right or list to the left that were on these tracks running in the water, and they had to be executed to exactly our storyboards. Then we cut it together, and it was the most kind of worst looking scene. You would look at it and go, oh God, this looks like toy boats on a track that would list to the right, list to the left, and nothing's happened. There's no characters in them. And then you realize there's only one boat with a character, Stuart Little. The rest of the boats are empty toy boats. So now we're like, oh my God. So we cut it together, and we haven't seen Stuart. And then we see this gray mouse that comes. They do this little slider kind of piece to show you where he's going to be, the blocking. And it's like, guys, the end of the movie. We have no end of the movie. I don't know what we're going to do. Go to the scoring stage, and Alan Silvestri comes in with his music. And I've never heard it before. He's just playing it. The first time I'm hearing it is live. And he taps the baton, and 100 musicians launch into one of the most magical pieces of score you've ever heard. And I started crying. Because for the first time since I had read it and said what it could be, now I saw it was even better than it could have been.
Mm.
And for me, the filmmaking process is filled with that, managing those doubts.
I think that's very true because you're right. You have to remember what it is. And even when I'm working on something, you know, like when I was going to Goliath, it would take an hour to get to the set. And every time I had to be there, you know, 5:30 a.m. call on the 5 and pouring rain. And by the time you get to the set, like you said, I spend most of the time going, why am I here? Why is this important? You know?
Yeah.
And so when the people at the top have that same feeling, that's great to hear, and that they're not just looking at their watch and saying, we got to make our day, we got to make our day, you know, because I think it puts actors, you know, kind of on edge. I just want to end by asking a little bit about Cosmos, the show that you were also a part of.
Something I'm probably the thing I'm the most proud of in my career was working on Cosmos. And Cosmos was originally launched by Carl Sagan and Andrian and Dr. Steven Soter, who wrote, Ann and Carl and Steve wrote it, and then Carl was the host of that first season. And it's something I grew up on and was just, I loved. I loved because from the infinite to the infinitesimal, from, you know, the great design to the absolute pale blue dot of this little Earth, a speck hanging in, a mote of dust hanging in a sunbeam. Mm-hmm. You know, the reality of that is what, you know, Carl Sagan kind of said. So we have a third season. It's coming out on National Geographic on March 9th. We're super excited about that, and which was just announced last week, believe it or not. The second season and the third season are hosted by Dr. Neil deGrasse Tyson. And the show is equally as compelling. It's called Cosmos Possible Worlds. It's 13 hours of some of the most incredible stories that talk about our place as human beings on this planet, as much as it talks about our planet as it relates to possible worlds that are out there, places that we could inhabit, where we could be. Mm-hmm. It's very, very positive. Andrian is the writer and director, along with Brandon Braga, this season. And Brandon worked with us on the previous season, and he's brilliant. And she's the smartest person I've ever met, and I've heard Seth say that more than once. You know, she really is a great storyteller. So it was great because there were no techniques. There was no idea about it. There was only this love that I had for something that was made in 1980 when we set out to make it in 2014. And we went about it and came up with techniques as we defined it along the way. And we wanted to give cinema to a science show. And I think we achieved that in this season. I think we did it again.
Oh, good. Well, I can't wait to see that.
One question I have for you, Jason, before we go, too, is a lot of our listeners are up-and-coming creators. We have young filmmakers. And as someone who hears pitches all day, what do you look for in a great pitch? And what gets you really excited? Like, what do you think makes up a great pitch? And how do you know when you're seeing someone who's really going to do something special for you?
You know, we all have the stories that we like, you know, things that appeal to us. And some of them could be. And they form our point of view. And when you hear a story from somebody and when you hear a pitch, you want to find something that is relatable, that it feels, that it speaks to the kind of the human experience. Mm. I look for a great setup, complications along the way, and then an unexpected ending. And if I hear those three elements typically set in a story that feels like real people. You know, the idea of, I always use the term hat on a hat. It was with Ted, it was like, okay, you know, if you put too much artifice on top of Ted being this kind of, you know, fantasy character, a fantasy on a fantasy, all of a sudden people disconnect. Mm. So you can put a fantasy element in it, but you have to protect it. You have to be aware. You have to nurture it so it doesn't feel like it's, mm-hmm. you know. So I look for relatable, undeniable storytelling. I look for new point of view. I mean, right now, we're in this kind of dynamic time in the industry where you're seeing so much great work coming from kind of fresh point of views. And for me, those diverse storytelling voices and putting them in there, you can take a story we've heard that's very universal, but now tell it from a different point of view. So that's, to me, super compelling and what I'm looking for.
Mm, cool.
Wow. I'm so impressed. That's such great advice. I can add no more to that, Jason.
Come on. You can add something.
No, that. I was listening so intently. I almost wanted to start taking notes.
I was. We're fine.
Okay, good.
I thank you.
Yeah.
Well, Jason, it's been it's so awesome to have you here. Thank you so much.
I'm honored. I'm a big fan of yours. To be part of this was great.
And I mean, how often do you get an actress who's worked with a producer who just says he's the greatest?
Twice.
twice.
And I haven't screwed this up yet.
Yeah, it's true.
You know,
he's the best.
She can't screw this up. I'm the guy who's going to fit. I'm so nervous. I was very nervous coming in here because of that.
No.
You know, something happened. She didn't get lunch one day, and it's going to come up. Now, teasing.
No, we heavily vet Jason, so if you get the invite, you know you're set. And I want to echo that. Thank you so much for tuning in, guys. Jason, you don't have the right to be as nice as you are. A lot of high-achieving producers don't have that same accessible, warm candor that you do, and it's clear you have a love for filmmaking. So it's just such an honor to have you here. And, guys, this is The Film Scene with Ileana Douglas. Today we had Jason Clark, whose movies, of course, you know. Hopefully you enjoyed today's episode. If you did, we ask that you hop on iTunes and give us those 5 stars. We'll start reading some of those reviews on air because we have a lot of wonderful, loyal fans. We appreciate your feedback.
Yes.
We're back in a couple weeks.
Yeah, we're going to take Thanksgiving week off, and then we're going to be back with Matt Oswalt, who's also got a book of photography out. And we're going to be talking about Christmas movies and Oscar movies.
It's all happening.
Whole bunch of other things. And as we end our show, as we always say, everyone's life is like a movie with a beginning, a middle, and an end. And this is the end of our show for today. Thank you, Jeff. Thank you, Jason Clark. See ya next week. So long.
Thank you.
Thanks for tuning into The Film Scene with Ileana Douglas, airing exclusively on the Popcorn Talk Network. We bring you this show for free because we're just as passionate and borderline obsessed with film as you are. And it would mean a lot if you would please subscribe to our podcast and give us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts. It takes 5 minutes to review the show, but it helps other film junkies find the show and continue to spread a love of classic and contemporary film. For guest inquiries or live bookings, you can email me, Jeff Graham, at guests@afterbuzztv.com. That's G-U-E-S-T-S @afterbuzz.com. For more incredible film content, check us out online at The Popcorn Talk, and we'll see you after the credits.
Our founder, Kevin Undergaro, and me, Maria Menounos, would like to thank you for tuning in to AfterBuzz TV. Remember, we're not just the first, we're the biggest in the world, and we're the only destination.
From producers Maria Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, and the entire Popcorn Talk Network, we would like to thank you for tuning in. For questions or comments, be sure to visit popcorntalk.com. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been a presentation of the Popcorn Talk Network.
The views expressed herein are those of the host only and do not necessarily reflect the views of its owners or principals.